Precious, last time we had the schus to learn, we studied the subject of triage, which is kedima in pikuach nefesh. And today, let's look at the more difficult subject of when one nefesh needs to be put aside to possibly save another. And the classic case of that, well-known, famous case in the recent halachic field of debate, is the case of Siamese twins, where both cannot survive. But it's possible that you could save one, but in order to do that, unfortunately, you have to take the life of the other. And that a very famous case that occurred in 1977-78 in the Jewish world was the occasion for a lot of debate about this, ongoing debate to this day about this particular problem. But just let's just begin with a word of background about Siamese twins to set the scene, and then I'll try to explain what was the particular problem in this case. And we're trying to run through together an analysis of the issues that are involved in order to understand the fascination of this fascination and difficulty of this particular dilemma. Siamese twins, as you may be aware, is a rare form of twinning, of identical twinning, in which, for some reason, at least the current theory is that for some unknown reason, when the two sections of the developing embryo separate, for some unknown reason, they fail to disjoin fully. And the disjunction, there remains a point of attachment between the anatomies of these two twins. The point of connection can be almost anywhere. There are two American girls who must be in their 40s now who are joined by the tops of their heads. Their brains are interconnected, and so there's no way they could be separated. They spent the last 45 years joined to each other by the tops of their heads. They sleep in beds head to head. They shower together. They date together. They are very well adjusted. The one is a country and western singer, and the one is a nurse. One of them said she had a dream recently that she was separated from her sister and she felt very lonely. So despite the very awkward nature of that condition, they seem to be well adjusted. There are two Russian women who must be in their mid-50s by now, who are joined from the waist up and are one person from the waist down. They have one pelvis and set of legs, which are coordinated, but from the waist up they are two separate people. Each of these permutations raises fascinating legal, ethical, moral, emotional, and halachic issues. If two women are two separate women from the waist up, but they are one person from the waist down, incidentally, these two are not well adjusted. The one has become an alcoholic, and his sister has liver damage because although she doesn't drink, since they share circulation, so the alcohol is damaged, and they come to blows, often they do not get on with each other, but there's no way they can be separated. But the problems that are raised by that sort of permutation, you can imagine. First of all, if a man would marry one of those sisters, would he transgress the issue of marrying two sisters? That's one shaila. Another shaila is, which occurs with all Siamese twins, is that marriage is a problem. There's a shuas yakov on this, and there are a number of poskim who've spoken about this, that if a Siamese twin marries, then the intimate aspect of marriage can never be fulfilled in privacy. Because the twin always has his or her, it's almost always women, has her sister attached. The incidence of Siamese twinning is twice as great in girls as it is in boys. You're never quite alone because there's always someone present. That's the problem. In the case of two women who are one from the waist down, you have an added problem. And that is, since there's only one body from the hips down, so in the intimate side of marriage, the question that this raises is, would there be an element of adultery in the intimate aspect of marriage, since vested in the lower half of the body are two personae, right? Even though there are fascinating issues, and each of these, of course, has been debated in the secular world, in the secular legal world, and throughout history. And of course, there's halachic precedent for all of these permutations. You get all sorts of connections. A woman by the name of Rosalie in 1910 gave birth to a live child while joined to her own sister by the sacrum. Right? They're joined back to back. One of them married and produced a live child. I think it's the only recorded case of a Siamese twin woman giving birth. The reason we call them Siamese twins is because two famous twins by the names of Eng and Cheng were discovered in Siam, joined, two little boys joined by the chests, were brought to Britain, and they were exhibited in a circus here for many years. When they grew a little older, they emigrated to the United States. They actually both married. They married two women. And the two of them used to spend 1 week in the home of the one wife, and then the two of them would move into the home of the second wife for the other week. They fathered 11 children between them. and they died within hours of each other when they were in their early 60s. So you get all sorts of permutations, each of them which raises its own halakhic issues, and of course it's a very rich field for discussion. But one of these permutations raises a very stark and difficult, particularly difficult question, and that is the case that was exemplified by these two Jewish children who were born joined by the chests and abdomen. Let me explain exactly what happened there and share with you the nature of the problem. 1977-78 in Lakewood, New Jersey, a yeshiva, kollel young couple gave birth to two twin girls who were joined by their chests and abdomens. They turned out to share a liver, but the liver connection was not a surgical problem. It was enough normal liver tissue that the liver could be cut in such a way that each twin would have enough liver tissue. That wasn't the problem. The problem was that the first doctor to examine them was struck to find that he could hear only one heartbeat. Right? Only one, two twins, chests joined, only one heartbeat. And what turned out to be the case was that they had an abnormally fused six-chambered heart. You know, the normal human heart has four chambers, even in America. And therefore, there should have been eight chambers to this abnormal organ. In fact, there were only six. There was no way that it could be cut, giving each twin enough of a heart to survive. The heart was located more in the chest cavity of baby girl B. It wasn't quite symmetrically placed, a very important fact halakhically. The heart, this abnormal organ, was located more in the chest of what they called then, in the press reports, baby girl B, and not in the chest of baby girl A. The children were flown to Children's Hospital in Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania, which is a famous pediatric cardiac surgery facility. And as it happens, the doctor who turned out to be in charge of this case was a very well-known American surgeon by the name of Dr. Everett Koop. And what's significant about that is the fact that he happens to be a very devoutly religious Protestant Christian. He's the kind of man who used to spend the night in the hospital before major surgery reading the Bible to prepare himself for surgery the next day. So have here, he later became Surgeon General of the United States, and he took a very Christian religious stance on abortion and various other moral issues. Now, here you have a fascinating thing. The family of these twins are Orthodox Jews. The surgeon is a Protestant Christian. The hospital, Children's Hospital, is a Catholic institution. And the case was heard in the United States High Court as well, and I'll try and explain why that happened and what happened in the court. It's a fascinating opportunity to see how these various systems, other than ours, look at the same moral and ethical and legal dilemma. Now, Dr. Koop said to the family as follows. He examined the children and he said this. He said, look, if we do nothing, unfortunately both your children are going to die. The reason is that the heart was inadequate to support the circulations of two growing children, right? All previously recorded cases of this nature had, in fact, not survived for more than a month or two, a couple of months. In fact, these children themselves went into heart failure on the 21st day of their lives. And, you know, what happens is the heart is enough for the circulations of two children when they're small. But as they begin to grow, it goes into what's known as high output failure, cannot support the circulation, and eventually the heart fails. In fact, 21st day of their lives, they had to be put into intensive care, and it was quite clear that if nothing were done, within just a few weeks, they would terminate. In fact, the hospital had a heart like this flown up from Colombia, South America, where children like this had died, and the preserved heart was flown up so that the surgeons in the United States could see what was likely to be the abnormal anatomy that they would find if they would open this completely novel situation. This, of course, is a medical nightmare. I don't need to tell you that. You're talking about the confined space of two newborn chests without knowing what you're going to find. You know, surgeons, generally speaking, it's well known in medicine that different specialties attract different personality types. It's well known. The surgeons always accuse the internists of being pipe-smoking thinkers who do nothing for the patient, and the physicians accuse the surgeons of being knife-happy characters who cut anything that moves. You know, there's a little truth in these stereotypes. Surgeons like to do something well, do it fast, be well prepared, get in, get out, and get it right. To have to go into a situation like this without knowing what you're going to find is a nightmare. Not only that, incidentally, but the hospital, which took 11 days planning surgery, in the event that Moshe Feinstein would give his ascoma to the surgery, during the 11 days that they prepared, many fascinating things happened. One was that the nurses refused to take part. The Christian nurses, authorized by their priest to do the surgery, refused to take part. They felt emotionally unable to go into an operating room knowing that you'd see a child die. And so they had to put a team of volunteers together. Another problem was that when they decided to do the operation ultimately and sacrifice the life of baby girl A to save baby girl B, they used two separate teams of anesthetists, which posed problems that had never been dealt with in medicine before. units. What you have is a tiny space of two little heads, each team of anesthetists controlling the respiration of their twin, but bearing in mind that anything they do that affects the vascular system will affect the other twin too. This is something never been dealt with before. Two separate respiratory systems and one common cardiovascular system, right? So there were many technical and fascinating issues, but Dr. Kutz's proposal was like this. He said, if nothing's done, your children are going to die. Let me try to save one. I have no idea what the percentage success rate is going to be, or chance of saving her, but let's at least try that. But to do that, I'll have to kill baby girl A. He was going to separate the twins, separate their livers, tie off the major vessels of baby girl A. She would, of course, die immediately. He would then complete the separation, carry the body of baby girl A over to a sterile surgical table that would be ready, and then take her ribs to graft closure of the chest of baby girl B. In other words, leave the entire abnormal heart in baby girl B's chest, and then close her chest cavity using donated ribs from the twin. That was the that was the plan. Of course, the difficulty here is he was proposing sacrificing the life of baby girl A in an attempt to save the life of baby girl B. Well, you can imagine what happened. The family, the parents, young parents, asked their rabbi. The rabbi asked his rabbi, and the Shiloh eventually arrived at the doorstep of Rav Moshe Feinstein, who was in his, I think he was in his 80s at the time. He later said it was the most difficult life and death decision he was ever required to make. And I'd like to run through with you some of the analysis that he must have gone through in approaching the correct precedent in halacha for identifying what needs to be done in this case. Let me point out that what I'm going to share with you is surmise, because he never wrote a tshuva on this officially. What we have here is what was said by people who were with him at the time, what the debate, members of his family and others, what were the questions that were raised and what were the issues that he looked at. Since that time, there have been many other vehemently disagreeing opinions in the halakhic world, at least two other major opinions disagreeing violently with what is purported to have been his reasoning, although both agree with his conclusion. Right? But Bud Kurdish, for example, has an analysis of what they say Rav Moshe said at the time and why it cannot be right. We won't have time this morning, unfortunately, to go into the longest of all the issues that were raised, but I'll try to at least give you an overview of what the issues were. First of all, the first question that comes to mind, obviously, is why sacrifice baby girl A in the first place? Now, I can think of at least three options that are better. No? Can you think of anything better than sacrificing baby girl A? Transplant a heart into baby girl A and leave the native heart in baby girl B. That wasn't considered because this case took place in 1978. The first time a baby's heart was transplanted, let me remind you that heart transplantation altogether only got going in 1968 in a particular country. We need to remind you, of course, where that was. But the first time a baby's heart was transplanted was in 1986 by Norman Shumway, a Jewish surgeon in California. And here, that was not even experimental back in 77-78. Second option? A mechanical heart, right? A mechanical heart. There's a lot of exciting research going on today about that, but even today we haven't arrived at a point where we have a fully implantable mechanical heart that can be used, and certainly not for children. And back in 78, that certainly wasn't a feasibility. Third option? An animal heart. Transplant an animal heart into baby girl A. There's a lot of exciting research that's taking place now about this, particularly trying to clone pig tissues so that they're genetically compatible with humans. Right? This raises all sorts of questions, but today, even today, there's a very early stages of research in this area. Although we use pig valves all the time, not a halachic problem at all, but pig organs, for that matter, any other animal organ, is rejected within 6 to 8 hours by the human body, and the genetic work has not progressed far enough to make that a reality yet. So I think there really were no other options other than either doing nothing or attempting to save baby girl B at the cost of the life of baby girl A. Now, Rav Moshe had to go through a number of issues here in analysis of this case. The first element that needs to be discussed here, and I'm sure you yourself at the moment thought would identify this question, the first question is whether these two little girls are one person or two. Because if you say that they're one person, then you're not talking about killing anyone, you're simply talking about amputating part of a person to save a person. Now, what's the halacha with regard to sacrificing part of your body to save your life? Are you required to do that? Yes. A person is required, although we can't force a patient into that for various reasons, there's no question that there's a halachic obligation to sacrifice a limb to save a life. Incidentally, do you have to sacrifice a limb to save someone else's life? You see, that's not a simple question. The reason is, in almost all cases you can think of, like a kidney transplant, for example, where one person gives a kidney, we're not only talking about the sacrifice of the organ, we're also talking about the danger to the life of the donor that's involved. But there is at least one case on record which does clarify this. There's the tshuva of the Radbaz, a fascinating tshuva, which is this. He says, there was a Jew in Turkey who was accused of stealing by the Sultan. Now, you know the Muslim punishment for stealing is cutting off of the hand. He was sentenced to have his hand cut off by this Muslim ruler, and he managed to escape. He fled to Egypt, where the Radbaz was living at the time, and the Sultan in Turkey captured another Jew, imprisoned him, and sent an ultimatum to the Jew in Egypt saying, if you refuse to come home, I'll kill this Jew. If you come back, I'll release him and cut your hand off. So this Jew in Egypt went to the Radbaz to say, am I obliged to go back and lose my hand to save his life? Or may I, b'shev al ta'aseh, remain here in Egypt even though another Jew is going to die? It's an amazing tshuva in the Radbaz, very, very well worth going through. He uses completely novel halachic reasoning, which I don't have time to go into now. But his bottom line is that if a fellow would go back and lose his hand, it would be an incredible act of chesed, but is not required to. He may, it would be very meritorious to do so, but one, in fact, is not obliged to do that. And in fact, that's the ruling we follow today with kidney transplantation as well. We rule, in fact, that it is permissible to give the kidney, but it's not an obligation. It's safe enough that you may, but it's risky enough that you don't have to. Okay, and that's another whole discussion for another time. But that is with regard to giving a limb. But to give a limb to save your own life, you are required. And therefore, if these two little girls would be deemed one person, then sacrificing parts to save the other, yes. If, however, we say there are two people, then we're talking about a deichi nefesh mipnei nefesh situation, which is a much more difficult situation. Would you say there are two or one? I think we'd be much more comfortable approaching this on the basis of two people and even then finding a heter, right, rather than simply saying they are one person. But the second question is much more interesting, and it's this. Rav Feinstein sent a message to Dr. Cooper Solo as follows. He said, Dr. Coop, you are planning to operate in such a way that you save baby girl B and sacrifice baby girl A. Could you reverse your decision if you wanted? Could you save baby girl A and sacrifice baby girl B? Dr. Koop said, ask the Asian rabbi why he wants me to perform the surgically impossible. And to this day, he's still alive today, he's not practicing medicine anymore, he maintains that it would be absolutely impossible to reconnect all the anatomical attachments in such a way that baby girl A could have survived. It's completely impossible. Only baby B could have survived. And on the basis of that decision, of that opinion, Rav Moshe went ahead and allowed them to operate. Now, what was behind that question? Yeah, and how does it apply to the situation? To understand this fully, we need to move through a few areas in halacha and see how they reflect on this case. First of all, is halacha breides. This is a famous subject that this case raised, that ever since has been debated, and there's many, many famous makaris on this. But very briefly, the halacha breides is like this. If A is trying to kill B, and you can no way save B other than by taking the life of A, right? And then whenever we analyze any halakhic situation, we always artificially freeze all the variables. We always assume that all the givens are absolutely clear. Just like the good old scientific method, you freeze all the variables in your lab. Life is never like that, of course. All things are changing together. But we always approach a situation with all the givens hypothetically clear. So if you have a situation, all else being equal, where A is trying to kill B, and the only way you can save B is by killing A. So Gemara Sanhedrin, Daf Ayin Beis, goes into this and many other places as well, applications of this, that you are entitled, in fact obliged, to save B by killing A if there's no other way. Fascinating debate in halacha. What happens if you could save him by injuring A and in fact you kill him? Are you also potter because he's a rodeis? Or are you only potter in the situation where you had to kill him? Okay, another fascinating discussion. But the basic halacha is, when A is trying to kill B, and the only way you can save B is by killing A, you're obliged to do so. What's the commonest application of this law? That's the commonest medical application. The commonest general application is what they call self-defense, when B is you. and A is the aggressor, you may preemptively kill the aggressor, hashkein v'har goy, right? You can get up and preemptively kill the aggressor to save the life of the pursued, if the pursued is you. That's the law of self-defense. Yes, in abortion, where the mother's life is threatened by the fetus, we can terminate the pregnancy. The Mishnah in Oilai says, "Mechatchen esa'uba," we cut up the fetus if necessary, actively, in order to save the life of the mother. And the most famous issue in this whole area, of course, is the Rambam, who says that the fetus is considered to be a roides, even though the Mishnah doesn't say that. The fetus is considered to be a roides on the life of the mother. The famous Reb Chaim on this Rambam, and Moshe Feinstein, and the Rebbe Kiva Eger on this. Fascinating question of why is the fetus considered a roides that has no intention to kill. And the Mishnah says that when the mother is already in the birth process, once the head of the child is delivered, or if it's a breech presentation, once the middle of the body is delivered, then the Mishnah says you do not touch either one, because that is what the Rambam says, kachi darka shaloilam, what the Mishnah says, that this is min shamaya karad filei, that yeah, and then you're not allowed to. And there's a fascinating debate, why is the fetus called a roides when it's inside, but it's not called a roides when it's outside. I wish we had time to go into that, but That is the lumbus of the sugya is located exactly there. Fascinating debate about that. But the point is that when the fetus is unborn, it's considered to be a roides from the life of the mother. Of Kiva Eger says when two people are roides on each other, the law of roides doesn't apply. It adds another complexity. Why, if the mother threatens the fetus and the fetus threatens the mother, do we yet apply the din of roides to the fetus? Rav Moshe has a wonderful chip on that. But that is the commonest medical application, and of course it obliges us in fact to sacrifice the fetus. By the way, this was a Catholic hospital. Do you know that the Catholics rule the opposite? The Catholics hold that if a mother and child are battling for life, if possible they save the life of the child and sacrifice the mother. The reason for this is that according to Catholic thinking, the mother has been baptized already, so she's guaranteed a place in the hereafter by the grace of the founder of Christianity. The child who has not been baptized has no such guarantee. So we do everything we can to save the child, to baptize him, to guarantee him a place in the next world, and the mother, having been baptized already, doesn't. My father, Allah Shalom, who was a doctor before me, who studied before many years spent, a number of years he spent in gynecology and obstetrics in the Rotunda in Ireland, a very Catholic maternity hospital, my father told me there were times when he was attending a woman in labor, when the husband would walk over and say, "Doctor, if my wife's labor becomes obstructed, save the child, sacrifice my wife." These were not cases of difficult marriages, these were cases of Catholic dogma. But we do not hold that way. We hold that the mother, of course, takes decisions. Now, that is, but roides can be very complex. I'll just give you one example. In 1973 in Israel, there was a very unfortunate incident in which a group of Israeli soldiers in the Sinai found themselves being fired upon by another group of Israelis. You know, unfortunately in war this happens occasionally, mistaken identity, and one group of Israeli boys was being fired upon by another group of Israelis. At a distance was a third group who saw what was happening. In the third group there were some knowledgeable frum fellows who knew the law of roides, and they wanted to fire at the boys in the second group and kill them, because if A is trying to kill B and there's no way you can save B other than by killing A, that's what you ought to do. What a terrible situation. They had a terrible, terrible argument about it on the battlefield and eventually did nothing. They held their fire and the boys in the first group, people were killed. When they got home, they went to see Rav Eliashiv to ask him what they should have done. Rav Eliashiv said, "There's no way you would be allowed to fire. That is called min shamaya karad filei, and you are not allowed to kill those to save those in this situation." There's no time to go into background, but think for homework for yourself. What's the difference between the fetus who does not intend to kill whom we do kill, and the soldiers who don't intend to kill these people whom we do not kill? Okay, that's an important exercise to go through. Clarify these a lot. But that you can get all these permutations in the law of roides. Why are we discussing roides? Because if we say that these babies are roides on each other, then maybe each twin could turn to her sister and say, "Look, if it weren't for you, I might survive." Right? That's where we're heading. That's the concept. Now, next step. What happens when a roides is one of a group? For example, let's say a group of people are sitting in a room and the building is surrounded by terrorists, and they sent in an ultimatum. The Gemara has this in the case of a Shia raid, a caravan traveling through the desert, and unfortunately it's been a very real halacha throughout Jewish history, in the last war and in the terrorist dramas, and it's unfortunately not unknown. They send in an ultimatum. They say, "Give us one individual to kill and the rest of you can go free. If you refuse, we'll kill everyone." are we allowed to give one individual? And we could make a very convincing argument. We could choose a person and say, look, my friend, if you don't step outside, they're going to kill you anyway, along with everybody else. So could you please just do us a favor? And is it? The Rambam rules, the Rambam brings down in Hilchos Kiddush Hashem, and it's absolutely unanimously agreed, we may not choose someone to kill, even though many others may in fact be put to death. Can somebody volunteer? What happens if there's a traitor among us? There's all sorts of permutations, but yet we cannot choose someone and send them out to be killed. What happens if the terrorists name the person they want? What's called yichduhu. When they indicate that, yeah, they surround the building and they say, we want Finkelmovich, we have a problem with Finkelmovich, send him out, we'll kill him, the rest of you can go. If you don't, we'll kill everyone. This is a fascinating debate in the Yerushalmi. In Trumas in the Yerushalmi, the Gemara brings a case like this. Sheva ben Bichri was an individual who had done something against David HaMelech, and he was now subject to a death penalty. He fled and hid in the city of Ovel. Yoav, David's general, took the army, and he went and besieged the city of Ovel, and issued such an ultimatum. He said to the people of the town, if you don't send out Sheva ben Bichri or kill him, I'm going to kill everyone. And Lamaisa, what happened was, a very, very old woman, Serach Bas Asher, climbed up on the ramparts, began debating the case with Yoav, eventually had Sheva killed. They threw his head over the wall, I think, and that's how they saved the city. Now, there's a fascinating debate in the Yerushalmi, Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, what actually happened, what was going on over there. According to one opinion, the reason, this is a proof, and the Rambam brings it, and the Ramor talks about it, and many others talk about it. This is the proof that when somebody is yichduhu, he's named, you could kill him in order to save everyone. How would you critique that? What's the fault with that reasoning? The obvious problem is, he wasn't only named, he was guilty. He was guilty. The Taz says, by the way, he doesn't have to be guilty of a capital offense. All he has to be is the reason that the terrorists want him. You understand? He has to be derided from that perspective. Right? Even though al pi halacha he might not be chayav mitzvah. But be that as it. Oh no, he wasn't. First of all, he was accused. No one said he did it. And secondly, cutting the hand off is not a halachically appropriate thing, and you're not chayav for that, for sure. So it's like this. One opinion is that the reason is that if a fellow is named, he can be killed in order to save everyone else. The moral difference is clear. Why? We are not making the selection. That person is already a Gavra Katana. The only question is whether everyone else has to die. The other shit in the Yerushalmi is no. He was named and guilty. That's why they could kill him. The opposition says no. He just happened to be guilty, but that's not necessary. Okay. The Rambam rules Lekula. When we say Lekula, we mean that you cannot kill such a person. Lekula for the individual, you can't kill him. The Ramor brings both opinions and doesn't take sides. And this is a debate right throughout the Rishonim. Are we allowed to kill such an individual or not? But at least there's one shit in the Rishonim that if the person's named and not guilty, that's good enough. What does that mean for our twins? When Dr. Koop told Rav Moshe Feinstein that baby girl A is designated, that means there's no way we can save her. She is the Redek, and there's no way we could redefine the situation the other way around. She's definitely, as it were, Yichdu. Then, at least according to one shita, we could say possibly that's enough reason to deem her like a fetus threatening the mother, and that's why we kill. Rav Dov Pavarsky in the Bad Kodesh raises the obvious question: how can you deem her like a redef? A redef, the child is a redef only when it's unborn. The Mishnah Beferish says when the child's born, then he's not a redef anymore. Then ain't nogin, you don't touch them. So how come this child is still like a redef even though he is born? Okay, we don't have time to go into it now. Fascinating discussion. Many solutions that he poses, his own solution to that, and. It's a fascinating discussion, but this is the general trend of thinking. There's very little time left. There's much more to say. Let me just tell you briefly, in fact, what happened here. Many other questions were raised, of course. One of the young rabbis in the discussion asked Rav Moshe Feinstein, what happens if two people are coming down by a parachute and the one parachute fails to open? So the fellow grabs his friend's leg, but due to his weight, the other fellow's parachute begins to rip. Is the fellow with the parachute allowed to kick his friend off to save his own life, or may he not? In other words, is the heart like the parachute? They quoted the Gemara in Bava Metzia, two people in the desert with one bottle of water. One fellow has enough water, they will get him back to civilization. Why anyone would want to do that these days beats me. But assume you want to get back to civilization. If he drinks the water, he will survive. If he shares it with his friend, neither one. Is the heart, in fact, like the bottle of water? All these questions were raised. Meantime, what was happening was, a court hearing was taking place. Dr. Koop refused to operate and take the life of baby girl A without a high court authority backing him up. Why? He was concerned that someone might charge him with homicide for this act unless he was protected by a court order. And in the courtroom, three judges were appointed to hear evidence, precedent, and many fascinating cases were raised, and ultimately the court gave permission. But I must share with you an amazing incident that occurred in the courtroom. It was this. Again, we'll take a long time to go into fully, but very briefly. You must know, I'm sure the Hatzalah people here know, that one of the most difficult areas in medical halacha, in fact in secular medical ethics, is the definition of death. What moment constitutes the definition of death? You know, throughout the Western world today, brainstem death is deemed to be an adequate criteria. It's very problematic in halacha. But back in 1977 in Pennsylvania, the definition of death was not brainstem death. That came in 1980. The definition of death then was cessation of spontaneous heartbeat. When the patient's heart stops beating, the patient has died. Much more in line with halachic criteria, that was the criterion. Now listen very carefully to what the lawyer said. If this doesn't move you, there's no hope for you. This is what the lawyer said. He said like this. The definition of death is when the heart stops beating. What are you going to do in this operation? You're going to leave the heart beating in the chest of baby girl B. And you'll dispose of the rest of baby girl A. If no heart stops beating, no one can be dying. You know what this means? This means if you didn't like someone, you could hack out their heart, keep it beating in your lab, dispose of the rest of them in suitably small pieces, and it wouldn't be actionable as murder, because if no heart stopped beating, nobody's dying, huh? Well, you can imagine what the American judges said. They said that may be the letter of the law, but it ain't the spirit of the law, and they threw it out of court. What's amazing is in a democratic system, when people make up the law as they go along, you get crazy loopholes. In halacha, it doesn't work that way. Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch said the most amazing thing. He said, in a democracy, the people make the law. In Torah, the law makes the people. Anyway, the court gave its authority, and in fact, that is what happened. What happened was, surgery was undertaken. Rav Moshe spent 11 days fasting, debating this with his family, who are medically qualified, and various others. He has a grandson who's the internist in Laniano Hospital, and others. And eventually, Rav Moshe allowed them to undertake a surgery. And in fact, that's exactly what happened. Very emotional process, of course. And the chests of the children were opened. A junior surgeon separated the livers. Dr. Koop insisted on being the one to tie off the major vessels of baby girl A. Obviously, she died immediately. It was a tense moment. Would the heart continue beating normally? Wouldn't? Would it not? In fact, everything went well. They carried the body of baby girl A to the separate table as prepared. They never needed her ribs, because baby girl B's chest closed, in fact, perfectly, naturally, anatomically, correctly, without needing the ribs of baby girl A. And Dr. Koop personally gave the body of baby girl A back to the family before Shkia that day, so that they could do the Leviathan. And people present said it was a very amazing experience to see how the Jews and the non-Jews went here through the process that was required in terms of Moshe's Let me leave you, because it's already late. Baby girl B unfortunately died 47 days later of a hepatitis that she got from one of the transfusions during the surgery. Unfortunately. Are there any questions? Let me leave you with a question. Can I challenge you? Yes? Mm-hmm. If you get this right, the organizers are going to buy you a whiskey. Here's a question. Interesting challenge. 1950-ish, a man was driving his car down the Carmel Mountain in Haifa. Very steep mountain. And the brakes failed. This was an Israeli car. They never used the brakes before. He had a hooter, you know. Anyway, the point is that the brakes failed, and he found himself careening towards a bus stop in which 10 people were standing. That was the situation, right? Gathering speed, 10 people in front of him. There was only one thing he could do: turn the wheel, but unfortunately only to a place where 2 people were standing. I don't know what he did, but they went to the Chazon Ish to ask him what he should have done. The Chazon Ish said he should have turned the wheel. So the people said to the Chazon Ish, but does that not contradict the Rambam that we learned today? The Rambam says, if 10 people are in a room, and terrorists give you the option of killing 2, Right? Exactly parallel situation. Exactly parallel. The 10 people in a room, they give you a gun and they say, see those two people over there? Kill them. If you kill those two people, you will save these 10 people. Are you allowed to kill those two people? Definitely not. There's no question about that. So how come, why did the Chazon Ish say that if you're driving a car down the hill and there are 10 people, in parallel situations exactly. In case A, you're driving a car. If you do nothing, the Sheva Al-Pasa, the 10...
Well,
the
if you don't kill the two wheelchairs,
and in this case...
You're doing everything.
The car's out of control, it's not me. Not on the contrary. I'm driving a car perfectly legitimately. Through no fault of my own situation, if left unadjusted, unattended, this will be, by my Sheva Al-Pasa, 10 people are going to die. In this case, it's the car, in that case, it's the terrorist. In both options, I can act. In this case, I can act and turn the wheel and kill two, said the Chazon Ish, yes. In the other case, they give me a gun and they say, kill two, says the Chazon Ish. Everybody else, no.
I said the car is more analogous to the tank than it is to
a tank?
Than the other people.
What tank?
It's you.
What
it's
tank?
You're
definitely not.
You're out of control.
Out of control, not me. There's two names. Two names standing over there that I must shoot, or two standing at the side of the road clearly. Okay, think about this. The Chazon Ish gave them a distinction between the cases based purely on logic. You don't need any other halakhic background. Purely logical distinction between these cases, not a factual distinction. The cases are parallel. If he is, then I want that in both cases. I want parallel cases. Huh? You want two identically parallel cases. Whatever you say in the one, I'm going to give you in the other. What is the logical distinction between these cases? See if you can figure that out, and thank you very much for this.